Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa. God knows you put your life into its hands, and it's both cradled you and crushed. But now it's time to make your own demands. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, an out-of-the-box think tank about community sovereignty and regenerative economics. We look at how to take back our cities, farmland, and water, our money, production, and trade, our media, education, and culture, our religion, and even our God. We present a people's history of the Bible and a parent's view on how to raise giving kids in a taking world. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Radio Free Brighton, Free Radio Santa Cruz, Upstart Radio Online, and through the Unwelcome Guest Collective. Multimedia transcripts to all shows are available on the website at thirdparadigm.org. Welcome to the 65th episode of Third Paradigm. Our title this week is Who Rules the World? There are a lot of answers about who thinks they rule the world coming out of WikiLeaks recently. But if there's one thing that the WikiLeaks have proven, it's that politicians and diplomats have someone else to answer to, and it's not their own conscience. The higher powers they serve can be found in mahogany offices and offshore tax havens, not in AA meetings. We're going to examine the exponential wealth of those who are 1 in 100 million. As John Perkins said in a recent episode of Unwelcome Guest, it's not even a pyramid. It's like a needle going up with a few very wealthy, very powerful people sitting at the top. If you were to plot global wealth distribution on a graph, this line would be invisible to the naked eye. Are they invisible? A Google search comes up with the 50 richest people. But these aren't the 120 people at Bilderberg. Who are the Bilderbergers anyway? And whose funds inhabit the World Bank, the IMF, and the Inter-American Development Fund? We'll get one answer in rhyme with a YouTube video called The Banker. Next, we'll go from the richest 0.000001%, or 1 in 100 million, to the mere top 0.001%, or 1 in 100,000. This includes, who'da thunk it, the children's author Daniel Handler, better known as Lemony Snicket. We'll excerpt his very funny article in the New York Times called Adjusted Income. After that lighter moment from the King of Dismal, we'll ask, is the world bankrupt? But first, let's hear some poems to keep things in perspective. This is one of Rainier Maria Rilke's Sonnets to Orpheus, a poem of Anna Akhmatova and a Native American story. The music is Moonflower by Kiko Matsui. Sonnets to Orpheus, Part 2, Number 10. The machine endangers all we have made. We allow it to rule instead of obey. To build a house, cut the stone sharp and fast. The carver's hand takes too long to feel its way. The machine never hesitates, or we might escape and its factories subside into silence. It thinks it's alive and does everything better. With equal resolve, it creates and destroys. But life holds mystery for us yet. In 100 places, we can still sense the source, a play of pure powers that, when you feel it, brings you to your knees. There are yet words that come near the unsayable. And from crumbling stones, a new music, to make a sacred dwelling in a place we cannot own. Rainier Maria Rilke, In Praise of Mortality, translated by Anita Barrows and Joanna Macy. Everything is plundered, betrayed, sold. Death's great black wing scrapes the air. Misery gnaws to the bone. Why, then, do we not despair? By day, from the surrounding woods, cherries blow summer into town. At night, the deep transparent skies glitter with new galaxies. And the miraculous comes so close to the ruined dirty houses, something not known to anyone at all. but wild in our breast for centuries. Anna Akhmatova, Poems of Akhmatova, edited and translated by Stanley Kunitz with Max Hayward. A Native American grandfather was talking to his grandson about how he felt. He said, "I feel as if I have two wolves fighting in my heart. One is the vengeful, angry, violent one. The other wolf is the loving, compassionate one." The grandson asked him, "Which wolf will win the fight in your heart?" The grandfather answered, "The one I feed." Native American story. The music was Moonflower by Kiko Matsui from her Deep Blue CD. In Rainier Maria Rilke's Sonnets to Orpheus, he talks about the machine. This is an appropriate metaphor for our question today of who rules the world. Analyst and historian Michael Parenti distinguishes between structuralist and functionalist. A structuralist is a person who believes that the system determines what a person can or can't do in the role. A functionalist thinks that if you get the right person into the right role, they can do anything. A structuralist would say that it's not a question of who rules the world, but what. The system, or the machine as Rilke calls it, has taken over. Rafael Correa revealed himself to be a structuralist when he said of Obama, "I know he's a very good person, but the system has his own agenda." I notice that system is masculine in Spanish. Of course. In the Native American story, we each have the potential for good and evil. Which side does the system feed? When we look at the principles of capitalism, it's easy to see why a psychopath would rise to the top. The system isn't personal. It doesn't pick and choose. But someone who operates without a conscience is unencumbered, while the rest of us are busy keeping the wolves fighting in our hearts at bay. But we, as a society, also feed the system, which determines which wolf will win. With the help of the website Visual Economics, I assembled a list of the wealthiest families in the world. The Waltons topped the list with $72.4 billion altogether. Robson, the number one son, spoke at the climate change conference about sustainability as a key issue to Walmart. Democracy Now! Tried to ask him how Walmart affects the sustainability of local businesses. Or, I'd add, the sustainability of sweatshop factory workers. He dodged the question. The wealthiest individual, who's now overtaken Bill Gates, is Carlos Slim Helú. He generated a wave of privatizations in Mexico, starting with Telmex, the telecom monopoly. In the UK Guardian, Paul Harris writes that his controlling stakes in 222 companies and minority stakes in countless more add up to a third of Mexico's stock market index. Although he lives a modest life, his tentacles have turned Mexico into Slimlandia. Next are two sibling pairs, Mukesh and Anil Ambani, who rule India, and Carl and Theo Albrecht of Germany. A Banned in India biography called The Polyester Prince touts itself as the real story of Anil Ambani. He sued his brother Mukesh and the New York Times for writing that he oversaw an intelligence agency that tracked the activity of bureaucrats and competitors. Carlos Slim just put in $250 million to prop up the New York Times. So this would be suing his neighbor on the list. The Albrechts made their fortune with the Aldi supermarket chain. Theo, who just died at 88, started Trader Joe's, which swaddles vegetables in plastic and sells unsustainable seafood to the crunchy granola set. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, next on the list, have a reputation for philanthropy. Although Gates' investment in the Green Revolution and Monsanto seems self-serving, Buffett's quote that he wants to pay more taxes is everyone's favorite soundbite, it seems. He also suggests that we read When Money Dies by Adam Ferguson, about Weimar Germany in the 1920s, and suggests that the same hyperinflation is around the corner. He doesn't, however, tell us what to do about it. The Koch brothers are up next, whose nefarious dealings need no elaboration. Then the Mars siblings, Jacqueline, Forrest, and John, who inherited the candy and pet food dynasty. Along with Hershey and the chocolate industry, M&M Mars has manipulated the price of cocoa beans to be under the cost of production, making child slavery prevalent in the Ivory Coast. Other brand-name billionaires include Larry Ellison of Oracle, Ingvar Kamprad of IKEA, Hans and Brigitte Rausing, whose father invented the Tetra Pak you know from your school milk carton. Then comes Bernard Arnault, who made his money with Christian Dior and Louis Vuitton, Li Ka-shing of Hong Kong, and Michael Bloomberg, mayor of New York City, where information technology scams that embezzled taxpayer funds have been making the news lately. Altogether, these 50 people have $715 billion in assets. Societies have fed these fat cats with our consumer dollars, whether it's through housewares, entertainment, cheap goods, cheap chocolate, or overpriced ugly purses. They haven't stolen it. What's listed on this chart is funny money for sure. The last amount that a Ponzi scheme stock sold for multiplied by their shares, or the face value of a real estate on the green side of the monopoly board. These are publicly disclosed funds. But what concerns me is that I don't see the names of any bankers here, or defense contractors, the wolves that we haven't chosen to feed. What about the money in Basel, Panama, and the Caymans? For every dollar in circulation, interest is being paid to someone. Where do those who own the Federal Reserve put their ill-gotten gains? They certainly wouldn't leave it in the U.S. Pay taxes on it? Don't be ridiculous. Somewhere there's another layer of wealth that makes these guys look like chump change. What I'm wondering is, who is the core convening committee at Bilderberg? The ones who invite in a rotating staff of politicians and elite fixers to do their bidding. In Unwelcome Guest, episode 528, Robin Upton asks, why have royalty, heads of political, economic, financial, and military organizations met up in secret annually since 1954? He plays a reading of David Southwell's Secrets and Lies, and then an interview with Tony Gosling, who set up the website Bilderberg.org, followed by two radio reports about Bilderberg from BBC World Service. The second hour is Daniel Estulin's speech to the EU Parliament on the Bilderberg Group, in which he suggests that their main function is to undermine national sovereignty and set up One World Company Limited. Robin then examines the conspiracy theory label with a quick sketch by Bill Hicks and a section of Michael Parenti's talk at the 2010 Santa Cruz Deep Politics Conference. The show concludes with Adrian Salbucci, the Argentinian political commentator and economist. Adrian's conclusion is that national government is used to put an acceptable face on the reality that a small coterie of corporate and financial leaders rule the world out of self-interest, unhampered by considerations of public welfare. The show is well worth a listen to understand the structure of Bilderberg at unwelcomeguest.net. But for the functionalist among you, here's a character study of the Bilderberger, a YouTube video called The Banker.
Hello. My name is Montague William III. And what I will tell you may well sound absurd, but the less who believe it, the better for me. For you see, I'm in banking and big industry. For many a year, we have controlled your lives, while you all just struggle and suffer in strife. We created the things that you don't really need, your sports cars and fashions and plasma TVs. I remember it clearly how all this began. Family secrets from father to son. Inherited knowledge that gives me the edge, while you people lie sleeping at night in your beds. We control the money that controls your lives. Whilst you worship false idols and wouldn't think twice about selling your souls for a place in the sun, these things that won't matter when your time is done. But as long as they're there to control the masses, I just sit back and consider my assets. safe in the knowledge that I have it all, while you common people are losing your jobs. You see, I just hold you in utter contempt. But the smile on my face, well, it makes me exempt. For I have the weapon of global TV, which gives us connection and invites empathy. You would really believe that we look out for you, while we bankers and brokers are only a few. But if you saw that, you'd take back the power. Hence, daily terrors to make you all cower, the panics, the crashes, the wars, and the illness that keep you from finding your spiritual wholeness. We rig the game, and we buy out both sides to keep you enslaved in your pitiful lives. So, go out and work as your body clock fades. And when it's all over, a few years from the grave, you'll look back on all this, and just then you'll see that your life was nothing, a mere fantasy. There are very few things that we don't now control. To have lawyers and police force was always a goal, doing our bidding while you march on the street. But they never realize that they're only just sheep. For real power resides in the hands of a few. You voted for parties. What more could you do? But what you don't know is they're one and the same. Old Gordon has passed good old David the reins, and you'll follow the leader who was put there by you. But your blood, it runs red, while our blood runs blue. But you simply don't see it's all part of the game, another distraction like money and fame. Get ready for wars in the name of the free, vaccinations for illness that will never be, the assault on your children's impressionable minds, and a microchipped world. You'll put up no fight. Information suppression will keep you in tone. Depopulation of peasants was always our goal. But eugenics was not what we hoped it would be. Oh yes, it was us that funded Nazis. But as long as we own all the media, too, what's really happening does not concern you. So just go on watching your plasma TV, and the world will be run by the ones you can't see.
That was The Banker, produced by 33rd Degree Films. Written, directed, and produced by Craig James Moncour, with William Montague III, played by Michael Daviaut. There's another YouTube video called The Banker, which is also good. It describes the effect of the Robin Hood tax, a 0.05% tax on each financial transaction. It would create over $400 billion a year, which could be used to end world hunger, combat climate change, or any number of other merry deeds for men in tights. It's being promoted at Cancun as a way to fund the climate debt with $100 billion at only a quarter of the revenues, as opposed to the $30 billion that nations have collectively pledged at the Copenhagen Accord. It would also cut down on currency manipulations and the millions of stock trades bought and sold in a fraction of a second for huge profits. Now let's go from wealth at the level of global carnage to wealth that's been earned and is only charmingly obscene. This is an article in the New York Times called Adjusted Income by David Handler, better known as Lemony Snicket. He writes, "Let's start by saying I have a lot of money. I've acquired it by writing children's books about terrible things happening to orphans, and this seems like such a crazy and possibly monstrous way of acquiring money that I give a lot of it away. I mean, I guess it's a lot. Let me put it like this. My wife and I recently became obsessed with a website where you plug in the amount of money you made in a year and find out where you stand. If your salary equaled the amount of money my wife and I gave Planned Parenthood one year, you'd be in the richest 1% in the world, which is pretty great. Still, there would be 60 million people richer than you, and that's a lot. They wouldn't fit in your home, for example, even though you'd have the sort of home that only the top 1% of people in the world can afford. Handler then agrees to lunch with a friend who wants funding to repair a historical building in San Francisco. His wife asks how much money, and he replies, "I don't know," and guesses a number that, had it been your yearly salary, would put you with those 60 million people outside your home. "That seems like a lot of money," his wife says. They have lunch, and the guy asked for $5 million. Handler writes, "I had my checkbook with me, but I never brought it out. I felt suddenly as if someone had proposed marriage and I'd countered with an offer of a beer. I stuttered something. He explained that I wouldn't have to give all of it at once. I stuttered something else, and we talked about gay marriage a little more. And then I went home and lay down on the rug, which is what I do when things like this come up. It's not the first time. People know I have a lot of money. There's no way to hide it, and I'm irritated by those people who have a lot of money but pretend they don't have a lot of money. Not really, not when you compare them to some other people. But still, I don't have all the money. A friend estimated that my home is worth $20 million, which it would be if after lunch I lay down on a stack of gold bars instead of a rug. Still, though, it's a nice rug. If the rug cost your annual salary and I were a noble cause, I wouldn't ask you for money, because you wouldn't have any to give. Your income, however, would still be in the top 15% in the world. This is why, maybe, there are so many noble causes and so few of them are well-financed. We all want other people to write the checks. They're richer than we are. I wrote the guy a check anyway, of course, and it was for a lot of money. At least I think it was a lot of money. You'd have to ask those other people, the 100,000 who make more than I do, and the 60 million who make more than I gave to restore the historical building. Isn't this a lot of money? Then why does it feel as if I bought him a beer?" That was an article in the 2007 New York Times by Daniel Handler. So how much is a lot of money? From an article at Jakarta Updates, I read, "The global pyramid of wealth breaks down the number of people in each wealth bracket. More than 3 billion people, or 64% of the world population, have wealth of less than $10,000. A little bit more than a billion people, or 23%, have wealth up to $100,000. 334 million people, or 7%, have wealth over $100,000. 24 million, or 0.5%, have wealth over 1 million. And so, working backwards, I came up with this. For 1 in 100 million families, their average assets are worth $19 billion. For 1 out of 100,000 families, who are in Lemony Snicket's shoes, I'm guessing they have about $200 million. 1 out of 200 has over $1 million, while 1 in 100 has over $500,000. 1 in 10 has $72,000, and every other person has $4,000 or more. What does all this mean? If the net worth of everyone in the world were put on a graph where each degree equaled $100,000, the line would be flat for 90% of the world's population. At 10%, it would rise 1 degree, and at 1%, it would rise 5 degrees, then 10 degrees at 0.5%. But to represent the wealthiest 60 families, on average, our chart would need to extend 190,000 degrees vertically, and then another 400,000 degrees to show Carlos Slim, and another 120,000 degrees to show the Waltons. Now picture this global money supply as if it's mercury. Every time that pressure is applied to the skinny little bulge at the bottom, that 10% that we call the middle class, it shoots up the needle of the wealthiest even further. An even better strategy is squeezing the other 5.5 billion people through microloans or IMF loans. That's a cool 5.5 billion for one measly dollar each. What difference is that going to make to them anyway, going one more day hungry? It's not like they're used to eating. But it's the combination that makes these strategies magic. Debt pressure on the bottom half keeps them working for starvation wages to supply the products, which are then sold to the other indebted 50%. Only 10% of the world's population has any chance to escape the Walmart chains. But what are the chances of that? The entire net assets of that 10% are less than it costs to be out of work for 1 year or send a kid to college for four. But that's not even the full absurdity of this concept of money that rules the world. I was posting on the discussion board for Wikipedia's list of countries by external debt when I noticed an interesting section asking, if all countries are in debt, who is the creditor? Shouldn't some of these debts cancel each other out between nations? Someone posted an answer that many of these debts are owed to private institutions. So I Googled, what is the net worth of the world? And it sent me to getmoneyenergy.com. This informed me that the world owes more than it has. Total world debt in the form of bonds equals $82 trillion, but the total value of world equity markets amounts to only $44 trillion. Therefore, the world owes $38 trillion more than it has. Divided by 6 billion people, this gives us an average net worth of $6,300 owed just for being on the planet. This begs the question, to whom? These bonds are so much money printed, and most of it belongs to the U.S. As we know, however, these are really debt obligations owed to the Federal Reserve, which is majority owned by the Rothschilds, as are 165 other national banks out of 195 nations. So if your plan to change the world involves a redistribution of money, think again. Money exists to concentrate power in the fewest hands possible, and it's doing a damn fine job of it. This has been Teresa Caraggio with Third Paradigm. Thanks to Robin Upton and to Daniel Handler for my excerpts from their work. Thanks to Mike Sirocco for the thirdparadigm.org website, where this and all previous transcripts can be found, embellished with photos, links, and videos. We go out with the Jayhawks from their Rainy Day Music CD, which is appropriate for this blustery pre-Christmas day. The song is Stumbling Through the Dark, appropriate to this blustery era. Thanks for listening.
You're so in love, little girl. So much in love, little girl. Running around in circles, why? You know it's a crime. No less, no more than a rose. No less, no more than a rose. Try to attach a meaning. Words that you've heard, stumbling through the dark. Seems I'm stumbling through the dark. Everybody's stumbling through the dark. The man who preceded us here left only questions and fears. The vanity formed by beauty lies. You know it's a crime. Stumbling through the dark. Seems I'm stumbling through the dark. Everybody's stumbling through the stumbling through the dark. Everybody's stumbling through the dark.